torch two outline for semester two. Starts off with vicarious liability, which is one person is liable for what someone else has done. The goals of vicarious liability is retribution, deterrence, and law spreading to prevent the activity from happening in the future. The first question that we ask is if the defendant is an employee or an independent contractor. If the defendant is an employee, the employer is liable for the negligent acts of his employee when those acts are committed within the scope of employment. You have to look at activities in furtherance of the business, such as going to work or driving a work van, and this is held under the theory of respondeat superior. You then ask if the relationship is one of an independent contractor. If it's not an employee and it's an independent contractor, then you generally don't have vicarious liability for the tort committed by the independent contractor unless the person retains the right of control over the work, which is a control test, or when the person hires an incompetent contractor, which is a negligent hiring theory. And the last exception is the activity performed by the independent contractor is inherently dangerous, which is the non-delegation doctrine. The second question that you must ask is, was the activity a nuisance, which is held under strict liability? A nuisance is a substantial and unreasonable interference with the use and enjoyment of another man's land. You have to keep in mind that you should not use your land in such ways as to harm another person's legal right. The plaintiff must prove that the defendant acted recklessly, negligently, or intentionally, and you want to use the hand formula for this. Keep in mind that substantial means that the gravity of the harm of the plaintiff outweighs the utility of the defendant's conduct. The third question is the defendant doing something abnormally dangerous, which is also held under strict liability? The defendant is strictly liable even when he exercises the utmost care. Now, there's strict liabilities for injuries caused by livestock, domestic animals, and wild animals. The three-part test that the plaintiff must prove as to the dangerous activity is the risk of the great harm should the defendant's safety efforts fail. Number two is the impossibility of the defendant's elimination of the risk, even with due care. And the third one being an injury or harm was in fact caused. Now, this does not require for the defendant to have acted negligently or recklessly. An important case in this is Rylands v. Fletcher, which was an action in which defendant mill owners had to build a large reservoir for their collection of water. The reservoir's barriers failed, and the impounded water flooded onto the plaintiff's working mine shafts. The court held that they imposed strict liability upon those who intrude a hazardous condition upon his property that, upon escape, causes harm to another's property. In determining whether an activity is abnormally dangerous, there are six factors. And keep in mind that you may be liable even when exercising the utmost care. The six factors include a high degree of risk of some harm to others, which is a high probability, a high magnitude of harm, which is a high loss. The risk cannot be eliminated by the exercise of reasonable care. The activity is not common usage. The activity is not appropriate for the place. And the danger outweighs the activity's value to the community. The only defenses to abnormally dangerous activities are plaintiff's assumption of risk and failure to exercise reasonable care is irrelevant when it comes to abnormally dangerous activities. The next question was, did the defendant make a defective product, which is analyzed under products liability? the case of McPherson held that a manufacturer of any product capable of serious harm, if negligently made, owed duty of care in the design, inspection, and fabrication. Now, this applies to all persons who might foreseeably come into contact with the product. You must look at the duty that the defendant owed, then the breach, the causation, and the damages. The first thing you look at is whether it was a manufacturing defect, a design defect, or a defect by reason of inadequate warning or instruction. The plaintiff must then show that the product was in fact in a defective condition or unreasonably dangerous. Such defects existed when the product left the defendant's control, and the defendant was the proximate cause of the plaintiff's injury. In the alternative, the plaintiff must prove that the benefits of a defective design do not outweigh the risk inherent in such design. If there's a safer alternative, the plaintiff must prove that there was a safer alternative. The safer design would reduce the risk of injury without substantially impairing the product's liability, and the safer alternative is technologically and economically feasible. There are no common law duties to warn against open and obvious dangers. And there's four principal theories of product liability. The first one is negligence, in which the product seller is liable if he acts or fails to act in such a way as to create an unreasonable risk of harm, loss to a foreseeable user using or affected by the product, in which you use a hand formula to analyze. The second principle is a breach of warranty, which is either express warranty or implied, express being a seller that makes a material representation such as regards a product's composition, durability, performance, or safety, an implied warranty being any seller who impliedly warrants that the product sold is fit for its ordinary purposes. The third principle theory of product's liability is strict product's liability. This goes to any manufacturer or defendant who sells a product in a defective condition unreasonably dangerous to the user or consumer in his property. The fourth and final principle is misrepresentation, which goes to any person injured due to reliance on the seller's misrepresentation of a material fact. The defenses to product liability is contributory negligence or that the plaintiff assumed risk. The next question is if the plaintiff was in peril. Here you have to remember that there is no legal duty to rescue unless by special categories such as statute, contract, or landlord-tenant situation. The next question is if the defendant was a government agent or officer. Generally because of sovereign immunity, you cannot sue the government under a tort claim, but a government agent or officer is liable under the Federal Tort Claim Act. Now, you have to keep in mind whether the government agent is working behind the desk. If they are, then there is immunity. There's immunity for discretionary functions, aka policy-making decisions. And there's also a military exception. The next question is if the plaintiff is a public figure. We analyze this under defamation, which at common law, you have libel and slander, libel being written, slander is an oral utterance. Defamation, there's three factors. The first one, a defamatory statement. The second one, it's about the plaintiff. And the third one was it was published. Now, this is under reasonable person standard, and they must show that there was actual malice. The important case to keep in mind is New York Times v. Sullivan, where the court held that the public official could only prevail in a defamation claim where the public official shows that the defendant either knew that the statement was false or recklessly disregarded whether the communication was false, a false standard as actual malice. It also required that this actual malice standard be proven by convincing clarity. The difference between ordinary defamation and commercial are false statements as to cause economic loss, intent, or knowledge. Time is up.